Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Okay, so we're on Canto 4, Chapter 31. Narada instructs the Prachaitas. And this is verse 2. Dikshita Brahma Satrena Sarvabhutatma Medasa Pratichyam Dishi Vilayam Siddho Abud Yatra Jajali Dikshita Brahma Satrena Sarvabhutatma Medasa Pratichyam Dishi Velayam Siddho Buddhyatra Jajali Dikshita Brahma Satrena Sarvabhutatma Medasa Pratichyam Dishi Velayam Siddho Buddhyatra Jajali. Dikshitaha, being determined. Brahma Satrena, by understanding of the Supreme Spirit. Sarva, all. Bhuta, living entities. Atma Medasa, considering like oneself. Pratichyam, in the western. Dishi, direction. Velayam, on the seashore. Siddha, perfect. Abhut, became. Yatra, where. Jajali, the great sage Jajali. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. The Prachaitas went to the seashore in the west where the great liberated sage Jajali was residing. After perfecting the spiritual knowledge by which one becomes equal towards all living entities, the Prachaitas became perfect in Krishna consciousness. Please repeat. The Prachaitas went to the seashore in the west where the great liberated sage Jajali was residing. After perfecting the spiritual knowledge by which one becomes equal toward all living entities, the Prachaitas became perfect in Krishna consciousness. Purport. The word Brahmasatra means cultivation of spiritual knowledge. Actually, both the Vedas and severe austerity are known as Brahma. Vedas tatvam tapo Brahma. Brahma also means the absolute truth. One has to cultivate knowledge of the absolute truth by pursuing studies in the Vedas and undergoing severe austerities and penances. The Prachaitas properly executed this function and consequently became equal to all other living entities. As the Bhagavad Gita 18:54 confirms, Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma Nasochati Nakankshati Samasavishu Bhuteshu Madbhaktim Labhate Param. One who is thus transcendentally situated at once realizes the Supreme Brahman and becomes fully joyful. He never laments nor desires to have anything. He is equally disposed to every living entity. In that state, he attains pure devotional service unto me. When one actually becomes spiritually advanced, he does not see the difference between one living entity and another. This platform is attained by determination. When perfect knowledge is expanded, one ceases to see the outward covering of the living entity. He sees rather the spirit soul within the body. Thus he does not make distinctions between a human being and an animal, a learned brahmana and a chandala. Vidya vinaya sampane brahmane gavi hashtini shuniceva swapake cha pandita samadarshinaha. The humble sage, by virtue of true knowledge, sees with equal vision a learned and gentle brahmana, a cow, an elephant, a dog, and a dog eater. A learned person sees everyone equally on the spiritual basis, and a learned person, a devotee, wants to see everyone developed in Krishna consciousness. The place where the prachetas were residing was perfect for executing spiritual activities, for it is indicated that the great sage Jajali attained mukti or liberation there. One desiring perfection or liberation should associate with a person who is already liberated. This is called sadhu sangha, or associating with a perfect devotee. The prachetas went to the seashore in the west, where the great liberated sage Jajali was residing. After perfecting the spiritual knowledge by which one becomes equal to all other living entities, the prachetas became perfect in Krishna consciousness. So, it's interesting that the prachetas went to the west. Yeah, Srila Prabhupada also followed in their footsteps, and you could say the perfection of his Krishna consciousness was his... Can somebody fix this? The perfection of his Krishna consciousness was also in the austerity of preaching Krishna consciousness and delivering that knowledge to others, people that were not qualified, and who, without Prabhupada's association, would definitely have gone to hell. There's no question of that. So the prachetas, because they had qualified themselves in so many ways, they were benedicted with the association of great devotees, Lord Shiva, Narada Muni, etc. And therefore, due to their eligibility, it was arranged by the higher authority for them to receive knowledge and a proper path to follow so that they could finally culminate in full Krishna consciousness. And because they were serious about that, then of course they achieved perfection. So it's stressed again and again in all our literature that the most important thing in spiritual life is sadhu sangha. Ado Shraddhar is the first business. If you have a little faith or a little attraction, then the next thing is tata sadhu sangha. You must get the association of the sadhus or the great saintly persons. Otherwise, coming to the stage of firm determination, it never takes place. One gets distracted. The austerity that's mentioned here is simply detaching oneself from matter, either physically or mentally. But somehow or another, one has to withdraw from the activities of illusion. But if one does not transfer one's attention to something higher, then again, that illusion will prevail and one will be forced again to participate in materialistic activities in the name of spiritual life. Because they don't find real spiritual life, the Mayavadis, having not taken up devotional service, they come back down to altruism, humanitarianism, and these kinds of activities, and they pass that off as being spiritual. It's not. It has nothing to do with real spiritual life. Real spiritual life is when we separate spirit from matter, we enter into the gateways of Vaikuntha, we engage in devotional service, and that remains, then we remain fixed in that transcendental platform. But without the practical activity, simply word jugglery, mental speculation, even if one gets to a point of recognizing that we're not this body, that is not enough. First step, all right, see what you're not. Second step, see what you are. That you can only find out from a devotee of the Lord. Only the devotees know what the transcendental platform actually is. It's easier to detach oneself from matter than it is to gain the association of devotees. It's easier to become liberated in the Brahman than it is to get the association of devotees, because the association of the devotee opens the door to Vaikuntha, yeah, and the personal association with the Supreme Lord. But that is not given to anybody and everybody, except through the agency that the Lord prescribes, which is the parampara system, accepting a proper guru, getting a association with real sadhus, and studying the shastra. So vairagya vidya nija bhakti yogam. Bhakti yoga develops on the basis of vairagya and vidya, which is mentioned here, the two things. That there has to be some austerity and penance, and at the same time one has to have knowledge, real vidya. And that combination can result, therefore, in pure devotional service and going back home, back to Godhead. So we see in the teachings of Lord Chaitanya to Sanatana Goswami, again and again he stresses the value of sadhu sangha. And there's that famous verse there, sadhu sangha sava shastra koi lava matra sadhu sangha sava siddhi hoi. Associate with the sadhu, associate with the sadhu, associate with the sadhu three times. And lava matra, even if it's just for 11th of a second, a split second, if you do that, sarva siddhi, you can get all perfection. So when that section of the Chaitanya Charitamrita first came out, 1975, that particular verse was a subject of a lot of discussion. How does it work? We all accept, of course, that by association with the sadhu, then you can get perfection. But lava matra, 1/11th of a second, I mean, how does that work? We've had millions of births in the material world, and in a split second we can go back to Godhead. How does that happen? So that question came up on a morning walk in 1976 in Mayapur. Panchadravida Swami, he was always a bit of a joker. He asked Srila Prabhupada, how does this, you know, work? I mean, the idea of an 11th of a second, that's like a split second. Does it mean that somehow or another, you know, you walked past Prabhupada or he walked past you and you just happened to glimpse Srila Prabhupada for an 11th of a second and now you're perfect? So, you know, it was a little difficult to understand. So Prabhupada explained it, that actually, it works in the same way that fire and wood are combined together. If the wood is dry, then the fire immediately catches and it burns. But if the wood is wet, then it will take some time. So he said, in the same way, the process of devotional service is the drying process. Yeah. Doing all the following the regulative principles, that dries us out from material association. The wetness is due to our immersion in the ocean of material existence. And so we have to get to a point where if we get that spark of spiritual association, that it immediately catches fire. That's the point. So it's a two-way street. It's not just one way. The Prachetas had made themselves eligible for liberation, and therefore they were given the association of devotees in order to achieve it. In the same way, Prabhupada was traveling all over the world giving his association. But there were many more persons who met Prabhupada that didn't take up the process than there were people who met him and did take up the process, depending on their receptivity. So that way then Prabhupada explained that we have to keep ourselves dry, then that association will have real effect. But he said, the problem is that we dry and then again we wet. Drying and wetting, drying and wetting. He said, this business is going on, so that's a problem. So Krishna can make all the arrangements for us to have an easy path back home, back to Godhead. He can give us the association of his devotees. Narada Muni is always traveling here and there. Unexpectedly, sometimes he pops up, Dhruva Maharaj or whoever it may be, and he gives them instruction. That is due to his association with Krishna. He's instructed, go here, go there, say this, say that. So if we meet a pure devotee like that, that's fine. That's Krishna's arrangement. If we don't take advantage of it, though, then it's a disaster. Yeah. We have to, or there has to be both things. Prabhupada used to say very often, guru has to be qualified, but the disciple has to be qualified as well. One time in Hawaii, when he was told that there were many devotees there that were not following the principles, but they were chanting and like this, there was a whole group there. So Prabhupada said, how they can say that A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami is my guru if they don't follow anything that I tell them? He said, then what is the meaning of disciple? He said, let them follow, then they can claim, yes, Prabhupada is my guru. So it's a two-way street. Krishna can give us, you know, all the help. He, you know, comes to this material world in various incarnations. He leaves his instruction, Bhagavad Gita and so many other Shastras. They're all, the Veda are all there. And his devotees are there representing him also. The holy dhams are here as well. But if we are not receptive enough, if we're not dried out, if you like, from our material contact, if we still have material desires and aspirations and connections, that will stop us from getting the full effect of the spiritual arrangement that Krishna has made for us. So we have to make a conscious effort to surrender. It has to be a conscious effort. Agyata Sukriti is okay, unknowingly making some advancement, but that's to bring a person to the point of real Sukriti, where they actually know what they're doing and they apply themselves to it. At that point then, when a person makes a commitment to Krishna consciousness, he can be initiated. And Prabhupada said that all the preaching that we do, especially in the Western countries where there's no culture of spiritual life there, all that preaching that we're doing, all the arrangements that we make for chanting, for book distribution, for prasadam distribution, is all to bring a person to the point of initiation. That's preaching. To just, you know, distribute prasadam or, you know, even books. If there's no follow-up, if there's no pursuit, then it doesn't have that much effect. It's like Agyata Sukriti. But when you get to a point when a person's ready to actually commit themselves, that's the success of preaching. Yeah, that's the real success. So Prabhupada's intention was to make devotees, that's all. Not to just go and smile and sit on a big seat and receive some guru dakshina and give blessings. Ashivad. That's not the real sadhu. Because Ashivad must be there. Nityashivadika Siddhanta Saraswati. That was the way that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati used to sign all of his letters. Nitya Ashirvadika. It means one who is giving perpetually blessings, which Prabhupada translated as your ever well wisher. That's where it comes from, that phrase, your ever well wisher. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati used to sign that way. So because they're well wishers, they take all time and trouble, all effort, all austerity performed just to give Krishna consciousness to others. So that can come on this stage that's described here of equality. Yeah, Vijayavinaya Sampane Brahmani Gavi Hashtani Shuni Chavas Vapakecha Pandita Samadarshanaha. When one's very spiritually advanced, when he's mature in his knowledge of knowing the difference between spirit and matter, then whatever living being such a sage casts his glance upon, he sees that all those living beings, despite the material forms that they have, he sees they're all equal. He's equally merciful to the dog, to the elephant, to the brahmana, and so many others. Because he's seeing within the heart of every living being, the spirit soul and the super soul. That's the key. You can't see the soul proper unless you also see the super soul. Unless you recognize that the soul is a part and parcel of the supreme soul, you won't see him properly. So although, again, the Mayavadis, they like to claim that they have an equal vision and all these things, but they don't see the super soul within the heart of every living being. So it's not possible for them to act on a platform of true equality, because the real equality is that every living being is a part and parcel of the supreme living being and is his eternal servant. That eternal servitude is spiritual life. And seeing the spirit soul without his function, without the function of service, that is spiritual death, spiritual suicide. So this merging into Brahman is nothing but spiritual suicide. It's not satisfactory. It will never satisfy the soul. And eventually, such souls that do merge, Prabhupada explains, they eventually come back again into this material world. But a person who takes up devotional service, functional, practical, does something to please Krishna, reciprocates with Krishna in transcendental loving exchange, that person never comes back to the material world. That's the safe position. That's the secure position. So the real sadhu is one who cuts off our bondage to material nature by reminding us of our bond to Krishna. Instead of being, you know, absorbed and connected with the material nature, we become absorbed and connected with Krishna in pure devotional service. That's a sadhu. That's the real sadhu. So such a sadhu actually can free us from this material world without a shadow of a doubt if we're receptive to it. All we have to do is just meet such a personality, but then take advantage of their association and develop it. So here we see the Prachetas are coming to the end of their journey. Yeah, they're now, they've gone through all the different things that they needed to do. They left one son, Daksha. And now they're going to the West to retire from all material involvement and go back home, back to Godhead. It's a pity that their son didn't take proper attention of what his fathers did. Because, of course, in the Bhagavatam later on, we hear about the trials and tribulations caused by Daksha. The word Daksha means very expert. So he was very expert, very unusual person. He was a progenitor of the universe. So these are not ordinary characters. They're not human beings, but they're very elevated souls. So Daksha was one of the progenitors of human society. However, although he was very exalted, still he made mistakes because he wasn't fully a devotee. So when he got in touch with Lord Shiva, instead of seeing him as the greatest of all Vaishnavas, Vaishnavanam Yata Shambhu, he was thinking that he's married my daughter, he's now my son-in-law, I'm above him, he's below me, and then he has to offer me respects. And then that led to all kinds of problems. So his hanging on to his material designation as a progenitor led into all kinds of problems and troubles for him, which culminated with him insulting the devotees and then having to be killed twice. You know, the first time he got killed, then at the jugya there, then his head was replaced with the head of a goat. So for some time he lived as a half man, half goat. And then after some time it became a little difficult to function that way. People weren't taking him very seriously. So he had to die again and then take another birth so that he could do his work. But anyway, the point is that Even he was very exalted and advanced personality because he insulted a devotee of the Lord. Instead of getting Sadhu Sangha, he went the opposite way. And he thought that, you know, this is horrible. This Shiva is a ruffian, he's scruffy, he's, you know, an avidut, nobody knows what he is. Now he's become my son-in-law, he's a shame to the family. He was thinking that way. So he insulted him, and then that led to his downfall. So one has to be very careful when we associate with devotees. Appearances are one thing, but what's in the heart may be entirely another. It's very difficult to know what's actually in the heart of a pure devotee. Krishna, undoubtedly. But what the nature of one's relationship, even neophytes, the nature of their relationship with Krishna, what's really going on within, is very difficult to understand. So we have to be very cautious that we take this sadhu sangha in the correct way. That means with all due respect. Yeah, Rupa Goswami describes the three levels of devotees. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also, to Sanatana Goswami, he describes the three different levels of devotees. So there's one level of devotee that's the majority, who are actually kind of materialistic. They still have, you know, material contact in different ways. It's still coloring their character. But at the same time, they have some interest in becoming devotees. They want to do some seva. They like to associate with devotees. But they're not full in knowledge. They're not at this point of seeing every living being as being equal. They make distinctions and differentiations, and some things they like and some things they don't like. Some people they like to associate with, some people they don't like to associate with. Some people do things that pleases them, and some people do things that don't please them. And in this way, Prabhupada says that the neophyte devotees are invariably envious of each other. Fault-finding is the hallmark of the third-class devotee. So if one remains on that platform, then advancement is very difficult, and there's always the chance of committing offenses against other devotees. One has to at least come to the Majjhima platform where one is, yeah, there's some distinction made, God, the devotees, the innocent, and the rascals. And there's a specific way of dealing with each of those four associates. But the point on that level is that one's heart is so full of Krishna consciousness, he has to give it to others. He sees other living beings are struggling and in miserable condition in this material world, and he can't tolerate it. He has to do something about it. That compulsion to spread Krishna consciousness, that is the advanced stage of devotional service. Then, of course, beyond that, there's the platform of the Paramahamsas. They see every living being as equal. They see everything as being the manipulation or movement of Krishna's energies. So in that way, they remain aloof. But for preaching purposes, Prabhupada said, even if one is on that Uttama Adhikari platform, he comes to or acts on the Majjhima platform, because those distinctions have to be made whilst preaching. That some people are favorably disposed and other people may not be, and may even cause a disturbance in the execution of the preaching mission. So in that way you have to avoid them. So it's not that the devotee is avoiding a rascal or fool or an atheist because he doesn't like him or because he thinks of him, you know, in a bad way. But just simply from a functional point of view, even he sees these people are also spirit souls, but they're so bewildered that they're preventing other innocent living beings from taking up, or more receptive living beings from taking up Krishna consciousness. So you have to maneuver around them. You have to somehow or another, you know, not rile them up or not mix with them to the point where it causes a disturbance in preaching. So a preacher has to have various tactics. But the principle of preaching is on this basis of seeing the equality of every living being and being compassionate, seeing them all as part and parcel of Krishna and wanting to do something to help them. That's the real business of somebody who's advanced in devotional service. So just like Srila Prabhupada, yesterday it was mentioned that Prabhupada also, you know, left home, took sannyas. And that is advisable for most of us. Even Prabhupada said, no, there can be exceptions if you're very advanced. Then you whatever situation you're in, it doesn't matter whether you're a grihastha, brahmachari, sannyasi, vanaprastha, or whatever vana you're in also. If you're actually fully dedicated to Krishna and Krishna's service, if you're actually Krishna conscious, that means you have no more material affection. Yeah, no more material attraction of any kind. So it doesn't matter then, even if you're a householder, that designation doesn't count anymore. Yeah, a real Vaishnav means that he's without designation. Yeah, without designation. Their only designation is Jivara Swarup Hoy Nichara Krishna Das. One is eternal servant of Krishna. So in that way then, Prabhupada, although he told me that actually I could have done the same things as a grihastha, you know, than a sannyasi, but he said because of this problem with his family, he had to take sannyas. So he was qualified, fully qualified, but his family were a little, they were also devotees, but they were not very, you know, they were not very good at helping him with his preaching mission. So at a certain point, Prabhupada found it necessary to separate himself from his family. And it wasn't an easy thing to do. Yeah. Although it was mentioned yesterday that when Prabhupada had, you know, one or two dreams where Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati came and, you know, wanted to take him away with him, and he understood, Guru Maharaj wants me to take sannyas. Oh, horrible thing. Not that he was against sannyas, but he had, you know, what he considered to be his duties. He had children, he had a wife, and he had a business and so many things. So he was interested in maintaining that, and, you know, he felt that it would not be a good idea to just suddenly abandon it. However, in the previous purport there, it says that at a certain time, one has to simply walk away from everything. Yeah, if you really want to separate yourself, if you really want to take sannyas or even vanaprast, you actually have to just walk away from things, even though they're incomplete. Shesha Prabhu stressed that yesterday a lot, that, you know, you'll never complete all the material activities that have needed to be done. Because as soon as you have a wife, and then you have children, and then, you know, you think, all right, when my children are grown up, then I'll be free. No. Then you have so many grandchildren, and they also demand. Yeah, and then great-grandchildren. You're building a whole empire there. So how are you going to get freed from that? So it's not easy to just walk away from it, and it causes a lot of friction. In Prabhupada's family also, the same thing. Actually, Prabhupada left home around about, well, in the early 1950s, he became an official Vanaprastha, although I don't think that his family actually realized that. Yeah, there's the famous tea or me incident. I was giving Prabhupada his massage in Hawaii one evening, and he started laughing. He hadn't said anything, but he just started chuckling. And then he said, you know my story, tea or me? So I said, no, Srila Prabhupada. I did, actually. I had heard it from Tamal Krishna Maharaj, but I wanted to hear it from Prabhupada. So Prabhupada told me, you know, how he had come home and his wife had sold his bhagavatams in exchange for some tea biscuits. And he said, I told her now. He said, that was it. He said, I told her now, you either give up your tea or you give up your husband. So she said, oh, then I'll give up my husband. So he said, she thought that I was joking. But he said, after some days, I borrowed 10 rupees from a friend. I got a ticket on a train, and I never came back. So I asked him, where did you go? He said, anywhere. So Prabhupada made that break officially. There was a certain point, you know, that was it. He had to get on with his preaching. Time was running out. So he left, but his family really didn't fully realize what he'd done. That was, you know, as I say, the early 50s. And then Prabhupada was in Jhansi. He was preaching there. From there, he moved to Mathura. And he came to Vrindavan. Then he was in Delhi. And in 1956, he was in Delhi. And he was in Chandi Chowk. And there was some cow and calf there. So Prabhupada stopped to pet the calf. So the mother, being very protective, charged him. And she actually flattened him, knocked him on his back. She gored him. I don't know whether there was any, you know, like real serious injury, but Prabhupada was knocked flat on his back in the middle of the road there. So he said that the first thing that I thought of was, oh, am I being punished for leaving my family? And then he said, but then immediately I thought about the six Goswamis and how they left everything for preaching. Then I was all right. So that was Prabhupada's mentality. So in 1959, he took sannyas formally. Then the news came back when the family heard, now, you know, your father, your husband, he's taken sannyas. They know what that means. In India, people still know. When you take sannyas, you're a dead man. You have no more connection whatsoever. So they were beside themselves. Yeah, the news came back to Prabhupada that when they heard that he'd taken sannyas, oh, that was like a lightning bolt. Yeah, it was a huge shock to them. Even though I had not been at home for years, but still they were keeping up the connection. He's our father. He's the provider. He's the husband. The one daughter was still to be married. She was not yet married. How can he leave without the marriage of the daughter? That was Bhakti Lata. Actually, Prabhupada had arranged for a marriage, but his wife was not agreeable. And Prabhupada said later on that the reason why was because she was thinking, this youngest girl, who's going to look after me? Yeah, my husband's never at home. The sons will get married. So what? Who will look after me? So keep her as a single girl, and then she's like a maidservant. So she did that. She's still there in Calcutta. I see her now and again. Yeah, she's about 75 or 76, never got married. So that was one duty that Prabhupada was supposed to perform, which he couldn't wait for any longer. So he just left it. He walked away from it. And the family, they were thinking, even he's a sannyasi, still he's ours. Right? He's still the head of our family. So Vrindavan Chandra Day, the youngest son, a youngest child, youngest son, he was sent several times. He was about 20 years old when Prabhupada took sannyas. I think he was born in 39. So 59 means he was about 20 years old. So he was sent several times, two or three times, to go and live with Srila Prabhupada in Delhi. And every time he would come, Prabhupada would say, all right, you can stay with me as long as you live like a brahmachari. And he couldn't. So then he would send him back. Then the family sent him back again. And then he sent him back, and then it like this. So their idea was that, you know, the youngest son should be with his father. That's one less mouth for us to feed. Right? Less economic burden on the family. If he's with his father, he can continue on. But Prabhupada was very strict. But they were trying very hard for years to get Prabhupada to accept, or to continue to accept them as his family. And Prabhupada, in the meantime, was very busy building up a transcendental family, which he was much more interested in being with. But in 1970, when Prabhupada came back from the West to India officially to start ISKCON, he'd been back one time before in 67, but when he came in 1970, he was accompanied by three or four sannyasis, and then about 40 devotees came from Europe and America after a couple of weeks, and they started the proper preaching in India. So they were on the west side to start with, you know, Bombay and then Surat and Gorakhpur and all these places. Then they came to Calcutta in early 71, and they had the first big Calcutta Pandal, 20, 30,000 people coming every night to Dasapriya Park, which is actually just around the corner from where we have our Bhaktivedanta Research Center now in Calcutta. So that was the first place where they had a big program there. So Prabhupada received some threats. Yeah. One of the threats was from the Naxalites. Yeah, those who were brought up in India, you know who the Naxalites are. They're like an extreme right-wing group, you know. And they were blowing things up and killing people. And so when Prabhupada had his pandal the first night, they were all in the front row there causing a disturbance. And they sent him a note, fly or die, to Prabhupada. Fly or die. No, Prabhupada, it's all right. He said, let me meet them. So he sent the devotees to find the leaders of this group. They came. Prabhupada sat with them. He preached to them. He spoke very nicely with them. And then they, oh, okay, he's all right. So they didn't do anything more, no more disturbance. But there was another threat that Prabhupada got from his own children. Nobody knows this, but I was going through some legal papers a couple of years ago. And as soon as Prabhupada arrived, within a month of him being in India, his eldest son, Mathura Mohan, who's another quite a bit of a character, he had been an Naxalite at one point, I was told. And but this was not connected. He sent a solicitor's letter to Srila Prabhupada telling him that basically you have committed a great irreligious action in abandoning your family. They're now living like dogs and paupers in the street with nowhere to go and no money. You say that you're a religious leader, but you do not know what religion really is. Religion is to look after the family. Like this. So it's a very heavy letter, 2 or 3 pages from a solicitor. And the bottom line was that if you don't give 3 lakhs of rupees immediately to the family, we're going to go to the newspapers and then everybody will see in public what you really are. So even in 1971, you know, Prabhupada was still having to deal with this family business. But he was very strict. He had, you know, as far as I know, he didn't respond to that. But in 1976, just to, after some compassion, just to make sure that they weren't homeless or, you know, in too much difficulty, he bought them a flat in Calcutta. And they still lived there, Vrindavan Chandra Day and Bhakti Lata. They still live in that apartment. So Prabhupada had to settle things up a little bit. So the point that I'm making is that even if you're as advanced as Srila Prabhupada, a paramahamsa, you know, par excellence, still there's so many, you know, hooks in this material world that try to grab you and draw you back. You have to be very determined, yeah? And the only way that you can get that level of austerity is to take shelter in Krishna. Yeah. Otherwise, it's not possible. That family affection, that connection that we have with so many other material living beings, you can't break that unless you replace that with a transcendental relationship. Once you have a higher taste, then your lower taste is nothing. Then you have no interest in it. So the Prachetas, they got to the end of their material cycle. They fulfilled their duties. And now they've gone to the West to become perfect. So similarly, Srila Prabhupada, he went to the West and became perfect and showed the perfection of real human life, spiritual life. So in that way then, by Prabhupada's sadhu sangha, those that were a little fortunate, yeah, a little receptive, have been able to take advantage of this process. And we've seen already so many of Prabhupada's disciples, because we're all getting to the, you know, our use-by date. but we've seen so many devotees actually successfully quit this body. It's happening more and more. Next 10 or 20 years, we'll see more and more of us, you know, exiting. But we see this transcendental family that we've become attached to. So we should develop our association very carefully with the devotees. And in that way, then we'll have the strength. We'll have realization also. That's the other advantage of being with advanced devotees. They have so much practical experience. It's not just gyan, but it's vigyan. They have actual experience in living as a devotee. And if we associate with them, we learn from their experience, then it makes things very easy for us. Yeah, we're all neophytes. But everybody has to make advancement, so we have to do that together as a group. There's strength in numbers. Yeah, and if we think that we can make advancement alone without the association of devotees, Prabhupada said, then you're living a great hallucination. Yeah, a great hallucination. So we have to learn how to live together nicely, appreciate each other's activities, keep the broader picture, have this vision of equality, seeing Krishna in the heart of every living being, and especially the devotees. He's manifest there. And in that way, then, our lives will be less troublesome. Yeah, and the so-called austerity that's mentioned here, it's actually not, Prabhupada said, what is the austerity? As he used to say, and Shrutakirti named his book, what is the difficulty? I heard Prabhupada say that so many times. What is the difficulty? You just eat prasadam, dance, and chant Hare Krishna. So what's the problem? So we make our own problems because we divert our attention and we keep up our material associations, and then it means there's a struggle. We stop struggling when we actually surrender to Krishna. Sarvadhamam parityagya, mamikam saranam braja. At that point, real spiritual life begins. Yeah. So these are another examples there of the Prachetas following in their footsteps. Just one last little point. When I was... I've been in the movement a couple of years in Australia. We had one devotee join. His name was Charles. He was a surfer. So he was very attached to, you know, the spiritual experience of surfing. I mean, in those days, you know, they would even advertise it like that. Oh, surfing, it's the next thing to, you know, the spiritual world. So he was so enamored with surfing that he actually had his name changed by Deedpole, his last name, and he had it changed to Of the Sea. Right? He made it all one word, Of the Sea. Charles Of the Sea. So that was his, you know, surfing background. So anyway, he became a devotee, and he was nominated for, you know, initiation. So then when the letter came back, he said, yes, Charles of the Sea, his name now is Pracheta Das. Prabhupada had a sense of humor. Okay, so it's nearly 9 o'clock. We'll stop at this point. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Badri Prabhu. We have the microphone.
I have a comment first. I was in L.A. when Prabhupada was telling on Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's appearance day about how Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur came to Srila Prabhupada several times in dreams, just as you narrated. And Prabhupada said, in this way he gave me no peace. He was pushing, you know. Yeah. And I think you made a very valid point that for Vaishnava, the reason for taking sannyas is this compassion, that let me dedicate myself to the preaching mission. Let me, you know, I don't want any distractions. Let me serve the, you know, deliver the conditioned soul. So that was a very nice point, that that should be the impetus. Now my question, it says in the purport, one desiring perfection or liberation should associate with persons who is already liberated. This is called sadhusanga, associating with a perfect devotee. Hey, okay, I'm out of ISKCON. I'm going to Radhakund and find a liberated soul. What is your response? It's right there in the purport, Prabhu.
Yes, well, Krishna arranges for our association. If we're sincere, by the grace of God, one finds Guru, and by the grace of Guru, one finds God. So, yeah, let me associate, but be sure who you're associating with, that they're actually following the standards of pure devotional service. There's a danger there. We don't say, you know, that everybody is not bona fide. But there are many in Vrindavan who advertise as gurus and sannyasis and babajis who actually don't come anywhere near the standard of pure devotional life. It's just, you know, a show. They wear the dress. Kali Chala. Yeah. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he wrote, you know, songs. And he mentions there, oh, just see, here's a person. He's got tilak. He's got Japamala, he's got, you know, Kuntimala, he's got his shaved head, he's wearing the cloth of Rupa Goswami, and he's a Kali Chela. Yeah, he's an associate of Kali, not Krishna. Yeah, why? Because he's doing all kinds of nonsense activities in the name, you know, of devotional service. So who is Sadhu actually is also, we should be careful to examine who presents themselves as a sadhu and see whether or not they're the real thing. So how do we do that? That means that we also have to have a little knowledge. The books are there and we should read in Shastra, it's described what are the qualities of a pure devotee and what are his activities. So in that way, then using Shastra, Chakshu, seeing through the eyes of Shastra, we should see and examine who is actually a bona fide, you know, guru or sadhu, etc. And then take shelter of them if we want to. But we shouldn't think that just because there's so many people dressed as sadhus that they actually are sadhus. Many of them, you know, even in Vrindavan now it's become filled up with Mayavadis or, you know, so-called devotees, but in their practices are actually doing exactly the opposite of what a pure devotee is supposed to do. Yeah, just as Prabhupada said about the Prakriti Sahajiyas. Yeah, they have material attachments. They read about Krishna consciousness or Krishna's activities, especially with the gopis, and then somehow or another they merge their own material desires in with Krishna's lila and pretend that that's actually spiritual, when it's actually, you know, the most degraded of all activity, most offensive. So we shouldn't come, you know, to the Dham with our eyes closed. We should come with knowledge. Yeah, we should understand what real devotional service actually is and how to practice it. And at least we can guarantee that Srila Prabhupada and anybody who's sincerely following in his footsteps, they can deliver the real thing. Yeah, we don't say that's the only place that you can get it. Yeah, we would never say that there are no pure devotees outside of ISKCON. But at the same time, we can say that within ISKCON, we do maintain the proper standard. Yeah, we maintain, we know what Prabhupada said, we know what is the standard of behavior. We have very clear instruction. Prabhupada said that in my books, all the information is there needed to take you back home, back to Godhead. So that we can guarantee. And it's nice, offer your respects to everybody else. Yeah, a Vaishnav does that. But we shouldn't, you know, allow the prostitute mind to flit from one husband to another, one swami to another. Yeah, that's what a prostitute does. She's got one swami one evening, then the next one with a different one, then a different one. So the mind has that tendency to jump here and there and everywhere. Oh, what's this one about? What's that one about? Yeah, well, we should become fixed. Yeah, accept Prabhupada, accept his followers, accept the process and all the wonderful arrangements that he's made, all this beautiful temple. Yeah, Prabhupada made it for us. He was already in Vrindavan. He had no need to go anywhere else, but he came back and worked very, very hard. And I can tell you, in India, Prabhupada really worked, I mean, day and night continuously for years. In the West, after a few years, you know, he got a few people trained up. He could rely on them for running his, you know, temples and BBT and so many preaching activities. But in India, when Prabhupada started ISKCON here, nobody knew anything, none of his followers. Nobody knew how to do anything here, and Prabhupada had to do everything. And he did it for years and years and years. And although he often would say, you know, I want the GBC, the temple presidents, to take up the responsibility, then I can retire and do my real service. Prabhupada's personal service was writing his books. He said, I'm waiting for that day, but it never came. He was still at it in, you know, just in the last few months, 77, then Prabhupada changed his lila and actually retired from active preaching. But before that, he was working I mean, you know, literally working himself into the ground, as they say, to spread Krishna consciousness as far and as wide as possible. In February of 77, we had just come back to Mayapur after being in Bhubaneswar, where Prabhupada had just laid the foundation stone for the temple there. So he was at that time getting very sick. He was extremely weak when we arrived in Mayapur. Just after breakfast one morning, he came out from the bathroom, and he was standing out. We were standing on the balcony of the Lotus building looking out across the fields. And Prabhupada told me, he said, "Never in my life have I felt as weak as I do now." So it was a great concern. I mean, and just after that, a week after that practically, that was when he became really, really seriously ill. But anyway, so Prabhupada made that comment, and he said, still, he said, "I want to finish this Bhagavatam." And then he said that, "I want to spread Krishna consciousness everywhere at once." That was Prabhupada. "I want to spread Krishna consciousness everywhere at once." So he said, still, I've given something. There was 108 temples by that time. He said, "I've given some basis. Now," he said, "you all have to develop it." So, you know, there's many great saints and sages, but we count ourselves as being especially fortunate that we came in touch with the greatest of the modern saints, Srila Prabhupada, because... Yeah. He's the one who actually took Krishna consciousness all around the world and fulfilled the desire of Lord Chaitanya to spread it everywhere. One of Prabhupada's godbrothers came to spend an afternoon with him in 76 in Mayapur. So they talked for a couple of hours, then he went back to Navadvip. So I went into Prabhupada's room as soon as he had left. This was Sridhar Swami, Prabhupada's godbrother. And Prabhupada was smiling. So he said, "Sridhar Maharaj," he just told me, he said, "that you are the real Acharya." Yeah. He said, this verse, Prativichai Chajato Nagaradi Gram Savatraprachahoi Bhaimo Nam. He said, "we actually never understood what this verse meant until you started your preaching." He said, "we all thought, you know, all around the world, what does that mean? Maybe the whole of India?" He said, "we thought it was some poetic, you know, alliteration. Oh, Krishna consciousness will go to every town and village in the whole world." He said, "we just thought it was some poetic expression. We never thought that it would be literally true." He said, "but you've actually done it." So he appreciated very much what Prabhupada was doing. So all we have to do, as Prabhupada said, is keep faith with him. Yeah, don't abandon ship. The waters get rocky sometimes. That's all right. No problem. Prove your worth. The rats jump off a sinking ship, right? But the real sailors, they stay on board. They, you know, keep everything running. So that was Prabhupada's blessing to us, that he gave us this transcendental boat of ISKCON to sail across the ocean of material existence. All we have to do is stay on board. That's all. Gradually, gradually, that purification will come. Is that all right?
Oh, it's very good. All right. I'm on board. I'm not going anywhere. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Yes, sir.
Oh. Hare Krishna, thank you for inspiring us. So as you spoke about the pure devotee, that they don't see any difference between the living entity, then how does he preach? Because one soul, he cannot preach to other soul. A soul means soul. Then what's his consciousness in that state?
Well, yeah, if one sees every living being as equal, then the same opportunity that he has received as a devotee, that means he wishes to give that to every other living being, regardless of where their body is from, or the shape of it, or the color of it, or the capability of it even. Yeah, Suni Chaiva Swapake Cha. You know, how is a dog and an elephant equal? You can deal with them in a transcendental way. Yeah. I mean, obviously, an elephant, you wouldn't invite it into your home and tell him, sit down and, you know, take prasadam with me. Right? Be a little difficult. Same with dogs. We don't let dogs come into the temple. But if a dog, according to this verse, is equal to a brahmana, then why the dogs are not allowed on the altar? Yeah, because it's a transcendental equality. The material inequalities tend to remain. Yeah, people have different cultures, they have different levels of intelligence, they have different capabilities, and this modern push to so-called equality, because the communists tried that, that was the basis of their, you know, revolution, that they wanted to make every man equal because they were fed up of being exploited by the rich and, you know, the poor class. But they failed. They couldn't make everybody equal. So what did they do? They infiltrated their philosophy into Western thought. And it came out, the old communism became political correctness. It means, you know, artificially trying to make everybody equal. The same thing the communists were doing and failed. Now the PC people, political correctness, they're also trying the same thing. Every government in the world, you know, is pushing for this human rights, equality, you know, and everybody should be the same. Yeah, so you've got homosexual rights, you've got women's rights, you've got Palestinian rights, you've got this rights, that rights, you know, criminal rights. Now, just in Europe, because the British, anybody that's in jail in England, they're not allowed to vote. You lose that privilege if you become a criminal. So now the European Court of Human Rights has proclaimed, no, even if a person is a murderer, a rapist, they should still have the right to vote. That's a human right. So this is all bogus. It's all going on. It's all artificial. That is not the real platform of equality. According to the Veda, there is no equality in the material world. There are four varnas and ashramas for different kinds of classes of men and women. And there's some certain kinds of duties that have to be performed according to one's material situation, according to the set of senses, according to the particular mind, according to the particular level of intelligence that we get, then we should act accordingly. So Shudras are not allowed to act as Brahmanas. Oh, then that's an inequality. But from a devotional point of view, it's not. Because whether one's a Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Shudra, it doesn't matter if you engage them in Krishna's service. They do what they're capable of doing, but they do it for Krishna. That's the level of equality. The Kshatriyas, you know, the Pandavas, they were Kshatriyas, they weren't Brahmanas. But they were the closest associates of Lord Krishna because they're fully surrendered to him. So when we say that we see everybody as equal, we see every living being as a part and parcel of Krishna with the potential to serve him. And a preacher means that he tries to figure out the ways and means of engaging those other personalities in Krishna's service. So even dogs and cats, they can eat prasadam. They can hear the chanting. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe you can have watchdogs. Farm dogs. They do so many things. So there's in Krishna consciousness, it's the platform of true equality. But all this other stuff, material, you know, men versus women, and, you know, black versus white, or this one, you know, political party against that one, you know, the liberals against the conservatives. Whatever it may be, you will never get rid of that on the material platform, not by legislation or by any other means. And in fact, what happens is in their eagerness to try to enforce artificial equality, they then discriminate against other groups that don't agree with them. If you're actually equal to everybody, then it should be a free-for-all. Anybody should be allowed to do anything because that's their equal right. But this is the hypocrisy. That they pass a law, no, you must accept abortion. Yeah? You must accept abortion. And now, practically speaking, it's a criminal offense to object to it. Yeah? Or, you know, like the so-called gay movement, homosexuality. So now you have to accept that as normal activity. It has to be advertised in the schools. The kids from 5 years old practically are taught not to make that discrimination. Yes, and if you do make the discrimination, then you get taken to court. I read a story about one Christian couple. So they had a guest house. And so two homosexuals came. And they picked that place out because they knew they wanted to cause a problem. So they wanted to book into a room. And they explained to them, we're sorry, but we can't rent our rooms out, you know, to people of the same sex. You know, we're Christians. We follow a certain moral standard. We're very sorry, but this is the situation. So they wouldn't take their booking. And they were clear, you know, that this is our standard. Next thing they knew, they were in court, yeah, for discrimination and hate crime and this and that. And they were found guilty. They were fined. They were given a fine that they couldn't pay. And now their whole business is finished, yeah, because they were targeted in this way. So if you're actually equal to everyone, then why you're bringing somebody to court, you know, in violation of somebody else's rights? The point is that it's impossible to make things materially equal. It's not possible. You can't get to a point where there's no differences between any living being and another. That's the utopia that Prabhupada said is not what Krishna consciousness is all about. Ultimately, you know, that's the Mayavadi philosophy, to make everybody equal. I'm God, you're God, we're all God. Yeah. So that's, it's all bogus, this whole material equality push. It's all nonsense. It's a good idea, yeah, that everybody should be treated equally, but it has to be understood in the proper context. Real equality means spiritual equality, seeing every living being as a soul, seeing the super soul within the heart of every living being, and then facilitating that living being how to revive their relationship with Krishna. That is the expertise of a preacher. All right?
Thank you for the answer.
Okay, so we'll finish there. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.